And the conversation suddenly shifts to,
there are folks in the communities that are being injured and don't even know it. In Livermore alone, here, during the 60s and the 70s, the Livermore lab took plutonium sludge and gave it to people in the community for soil amendment.
Yeah. When you hear things like that, you know that whether you want to be or not, you are in the seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
This week, we continue coverage of what's happening at the Hanford Reservation in Washington State, where last week's tunnel collapse and the hotly debated there wasn't radiation release continue to cause concern and trigger investigations. We will consider the kinds of care available to nuclear workers and what to make of the hotly debated there aren't cancers caused by exposure to radiation and toxins from Hanford. And we'll get an update on the Westlake landfill with Just Moms STL founder Dawn Chapman. That's where we'll learn what happened in the Missouri legislature to SB 22, the home buyout bill we discussed on this show just 2 weeks ago. Plus, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, the nuclear reactor duck and cover report on the latest reportable problems at those crumbling U.S. nuclear reactors, plus news, attitude, and more honest nuclear information than even the Russians got out of Trump at that closed White House meeting last week. At least we think so. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, May 16, 2017, and here is the week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting at the Hanford site in southeast Washington State, where last Tuesday, May 9, a collapse of a tunnel was discovered at around 8:30 in the morning, the tunnel leading to the Purex or plutonium uranium extraction plant. Technicians who were doing radiation monitoring to make certain the area was safe before planned maintenance work around the complex discovered the high reading, raising the question, if, as is claimed, no radiation was released from the tunnel collapse, how was this reading taken, and how was it sourced? The breach happened in one of two tunnels built to transport highly radioactive waste into the Purex facility. The tunnel that collapsed was built in 1955 using primarily creosoted timbers arranged side by side. The Department of Energy has said that concrete was also used. The newer tunnel, on the other hand, was built in 1964 with internal steel I-beams attached to reinforced concrete arches, and it has a steel liner. So in essence, it's more like a storage cask on its side. No such upgrades were ever made to the older tunnel. In all, 8 rail cars with radioactive waste were involved in this accident. A series of warnings by state and federal experts stretching back more than 30 years preceded last week's cave-in. A report in 1980 for the Energy Department, which oversees safety and cleanup work at the site, said that wooden beams holding up the tunnel had lost a third of their strength by then. That's 37 years ago. A contractor for the department pointed to the issue again in 1991, warning that by the year 2001, the beams would be further degraded. A group of academic experts working under contract to the department said more alarmingly in August of 2005, in a 2,000-page report, that the roof of the tunnel in question had been seriously weakened by gamma radiation and that a, quote, partial or complete failure, end quote, could expose individuals even 380 feet away to dangerous levels of radiation. No action was taken by the department in response. According to Alex Smith, the nuclear waste manager for the Washington State Ecology Department, as quoted in an Associated Press report, it is not acceptable that the hole could have been open for 4 days. Last week, Nuclear Hot Seat reported that, based on EPA radiation reports, the accident could have happened at least one day before it was discovered. Repeated calls to Ms. Smith and the Washington State Ecology Department office have not been returned for further comment. Spikes in Gamma 5 radiation, which is the kind that would be released by the tunnel collapse, have been recorded at EPA monitoring stations in Richland, Washington, adjacent to the Hanford site, but 23 miles away from the tunnel collapse, and also in Corvallis, Oregon. We also have anecdotal citizen monitoring reports of a radiation spike on May 10 in Corvallis. The fix so far, that's in quotes, has been the dumping of 54 trucks worth of soil to fill the hole in the tunnel. No addition of a liner, no concrete, no steel, nothing other than dirt, which does not mitigate against rain carrying the radiation down or dust distributing radiation around the site. We'll have more on Hanford and its implications later in this program. In other news, in Japan, a wildfire near the Fukushima triple meltdown site has finally been extinguished after a 12-day battle waged by firefighters and self-defense force troops in special protective gear. More than 185 acres were burned, and local officials have been scrambling to quash radiation rumors. It's well known that when a radioactively contaminated area has a fire, radionuclides are re-released into the air as smoke particles and thus become further dispersed and become available to be inhaled or ingested by anyone who comes in contact with it. We have an extensively researched article from Fukushima 311 Voices, and we will have a link up to that on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 308. On Sunday, May 14, North Korea's apparently successful test firing of a new intermediate-range ballistic missile points to a significant advance in the nation's goal of mastering the technology needed to hit the continental United States with a long-range nuclear-tipped missile. North Korea already has the ability to launch a missile into Japan, and with this new technology, it could reliably be expected to strike in Guam. More Cold War nuclear saber rattling. Between Canada and the U.S., the first of 100 to 150 truckloads of highly radioactive liquid waste from Canada has been unloaded at the Savannah River site in South Carolina, and the transfer container has not provided fully adequate radiological shielding to protect workers. The radioactive shielding in one of the containment vessels, referred to colloquially as pigs, was found to be defective, as a hot spot was found that could give an unacceptably high level of gamma radiation exposure to SRS workers. It's a manufacturing defect that underscores other equipment defects and malfunctions that have been discovered in the last 2 years, all connected with the same type of transport casks, on highways close to you. At the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth, Massachusetts, two valves designed to prevent radioactive laced steam from escaping the reactor's main containment room to areas where workers and the public could be exposed in an emergency failed a required leak test. NRC spokesman Neil Sheehan wrote, "Any leakage from these valves could make its way into the environment following a severe accident." Pilgrim is scheduled to be permanently shut down on May 31st of 2019, so why bother to keep it open and risk it, guys? And if that's not crazy enough,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
In Ottawa, Canada, last Saturday, families looking for a free, fun, family-friendly activity went to the Science Odyssey Fun Fest, which was put together by the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission. Whee! They promised hands-on science activities and CNSC experts to demystify the science of radiation. Considering that these activities were presented by federal government departments, universities, and external partners, meaning corporations involved with the nuclear industry, you can just bet that alternative information was not provided. And in a second numbnuts, Kara McCullough, A 25-year-old chemist who works for the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission was crowned Miss USA on the Las Vegas Strip. Besides being a nuclear professional, Ms. McCullough, when asked if she thinks that affordable health care for all U.S. citizens is a right or a privilege, said it's a privilege. She also said she likes to transpose the word feminism to equalism when she stands around in her bathing suit talking about the wonders of nuclear. But honey, if it weren't for the feminists, you wouldn't have a shot at being equal, and it can all go backwards as soon, in case you haven't been watching The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. And that's why you, Miss USA, and the propagandists at the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nut Nuts of the Week.
We'll have our featured interviews in just a moment, but first, Nuclear Hot Seat provides verifiable nuclear information, sourced and checked every week, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on various aspects of the nuclear industry that nuclear insiders maybe don't want to hear about. But we have those interviews in order to increase and deepen our and your understanding of the issues. If you feel you've gotten value from this show, help support its future, because we are volunteer and we need help covering our expenses. So please send a donation of any amount. We are coming up on our 6th anniversary of Nuclear Hot Seat, so how about a symbolic $6 donation? You can make it a continuing one so it comes automatically every month. Or what the heck, just go for it. Send us a donation in an amount that you feel is fair and appropriate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button, and follow the prompts. Know that I am deeply grateful for whatever you can do to help us meet our expenses and grow into our future. You will help keep Nuclear Hot Seat covering the nuclear issues that mainstream media just doesn't get around to covering. And for that, I am thankful. You know, nuclear apologists like to bray out the party line that no one at Hanford got cancer from exposure to radiation on site. That's why one of the more compelling quotes to surface in the past week came from Angela Hayes Carey of Nuclear Care Partners in Idaho. We'll get into a discussion of the company and the services it provides in a little while. But what caught my eye was an interview where Angela Hayes Carey was asked to compare the safety and health of workers of Idaho National Laboratory, which is where she is based, with those from Hanford. And she said, "I don't think that you can compare INL to Hanford. The patients that we see are completely different. The patients that we see at Hanford tend to be much sicker, have more exposure, and have the 22 known cancers that cluster around radiation, which isn't what we have seen from INL. Kapow! Well, reading that led me to contact first her company, then her, to learn more about the care provided to nuclear workers and the government programs that cover them, and then learn from her what she wishes she'd said during that interview, along with her providing important statistics and details about eligibility for government-funded health care for atomic workers. First, I talked with Laura Welch, who is Marketing and Outreach Manager for Nuclear Care Partners. She is based in Livermore, California.
First of all, what is Nuclear Care Partners? Nuclear Care Partners is a home health agency that was started exclusively to serve the men and women in the atomic industry. We do home health care with all of the services available from a home health care, and we serve men and women who worked at atomic labs, uranium workers, and everything in between during the Cold War at one of our atomic sites.
What, if any, difference is there between the kind of services that are provided by Nuclear Care Partners for atomic workers and other home health care providers that are out there that deal with a more general population?
Usually, other home health care providers take a myriad of insurances for payments, mostly Medicare. Medicare has very stringent guidelines for
home health care. People need to be homebound and not be able to get out of the house. They have a specific time frame. And Nuclear Care Partners is different in that we only take the energy employee's occupational illness compensation card, which is only given to these folks who have sustained an illness or an injury on the job during their work in the atomic industry. And we can start home health care for any of their needs earlier, as soon as they have a need. They do not have to be homebound at all. We can start as little as 1 hour a week, and we can go up to 24 hours a day if it's warranted and approved by the Department of Labor.
And you said that the company was founded specifically to provide services to government workers injured by nuclear contamination or exposure.
That's true. Our founders are actually two registered nurses who worked for a very similar company out in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And they felt that it was time to move on and that they could provide a better service for the same individuals elsewhere. So they began their own company with the aim of only serving 10 patients to see if they could be successful and to bring jobs to the local economies around these old nuclear sites. So they began with a very small vision that has built into serving hundreds of patients throughout the country now.
What work has the company done with the workers from the Hanford site?
We just opened a new site up in Hanford, Washington. We have people on the ground there. We're doing outreaches. We are trying to find these workers, and we have several of them in authorization right now. There is an authorization process when we do find the workers. If they don't have their medical benefits card, we point them in the direction of how to file a claim. And then once they do get approved for their medical benefits card, then we start the process of getting them approved for health care at home. So we do a lot of outreaches, and we are constantly looking for new patients who have been injured that may not know about the program.
There was a report on KBVI-TV, the NBC station for Pocatello and Idaho Falls, that included this quote from Angela Hayes Carey of Nuclear Care Partners. She said, "I don't think that you can compare Idaho National Laboratories," that was what was under discussion for this interview, "Idaho National Laboratories to Hanford. The patients that we see are completely different. The patients that we see at Hanford tend to be much sicker, have more exposure, and have the 22 known cancers that cluster around radiation," which isn't what we have seen from INL.
Absolutely. Hanford workers are some of the most ill workers in the nation in the nuclear complex. And Hanford continues to be a cleanup site right now. Just the other day, there was a tunnel collapse of where they were storing nuclear radiation underground. And they say nobody was injured, but who knows? It's an endemic problem in the Hanford area, and there are so many sick people. I have patients down in California who used to work at Hanford, and those are among my sickest patients that we see.
Has there been any kind of an epidemiological study or a crunching of the numbers to figure out exactly how severe the problem is at Hanford and anything at all about the cancer profile?
There is an epidemiological study on the Department of Energy's website, and you take it with a grain of salt. It's based upon the government's own numbers and algorithms and studies, so you tend to think that maybe they're erring on the side that is a little better looking for them than is actually the case. When our folks go out to Hanford or any other hot site, they see the reality. They see these folks who are sick. They see the survivors of the patients that didn't make it to go to these meetings. And we just want to help everybody, and we want to make sure that the nation knows that these are some of the most forgotten workers in America who put their lives on the line every day.
You know, the nuclear industry is fond of saying that no one at Hanford gets cancer. And the chief media shill behind this, I would label him as such, is James Conca, of course, who has already weighed in on a series of tweets to Susanna Frame from King 5 and also Ronan Farrow, who is an investigative reporter as well, saying about cancer claims at Hanford, quote, still nonsense. You can always find cancers everywhere. No connection to work at Hanford. We tried for years. Have you ever been contacted, or has the company ever been contacted by James Conca or his representatives to speak about the health impact? And what would you say to his statement?
I would refer the gentleman to our founders, Jenna and Leslie. I have not been contacted. I don't know that our management team has been contacted, but it sounds like a spurious claim.
How long has the company been doing this work, and approximately how many workers from Hanford have been seen in that time?
We have been doing this for about 6 years now, and we have quite a few people from Hanford. As I said, we just opened our Hanford office this year, so the Department of Labor being what it is, we can find the sick folks, but then they have to be approved for home health care, and that in and of itself can be a long process, ranging from 2 months to 2 years. So the number of people who are in the process are many. The ones that we have actually been able to service yet are few so far, but we do have a pipeline of folks waiting for approval so that we can begin care for them.
What has been your biggest frustration in being able to provide the necessary medical services to Hanford workers?
Hanford workers generally, and everybody else specifically, the biggest frustration is the approval process. Second to that would be finding the workers. Sometimes the government doesn't do a good job in letting these folks know that they have benefits coming to them. The folks who are actual employees at the nuclear site usually get mailings from the different labs telling them about the benefits, but there's myriad workers who are day laborers, contractors, folks that come in for specific tasks that aren't actual employees, and those are the folks that are falling through the cracks. Those are the folks that are needles in the haystack for us, trying to find these people, because often they're suffering in silence and don't realize that they have a genuine benefit and compensation coming to them for the work that they performed.
And when you say benefit and compensation, what does that consist of?
For the energy workers' benefit, there are two parts, Part B and Part E. It's the Energy Employee Occupational Illness Compensation Act. Part B provides for up to $150,000 if they can prove that they're illness was caused by radiation. Part E is for toxic chemical exposure and whole body impairment, and that compensation is up to $250,000, and both are tax-free. In addition to these monetary benefits comes medical benefits. They also get a medical benefits card that will pay for their covered condition for the rest of their life, anything connected to their covered condition. And that's where Nuclear Care Partners comes in. We can provide home health care services in their home for the rest of their life if it is deemed appropriate.
Let's get this one out of the way. If the James Concas and other nuclear apologists wanted to discount what you're telling me, what's the most likely attempted takedown they would make, and how would you counter that? I guess what I'm getting at is, are you just doing this because you can make a lot of money off of it, and really it's to your benefit to prove cancer cases and other illnesses, whether they exist or not?
What I would say is Nuclear Care Partners isn't in the business of proving the cancer claims. We're in the business of helping those who have worked tirelessly for our country during the Cold War, during the Manhattan Project, in secret, often with no personal protection, who were exposed to radiation, toxic chemicals, and are now, decades later, paying the price with their lives. I challenge him to look these folks directly in in the face and tell them that they don't merit this treatment and these benefits.
And is this benefit strictly for workers at the weapons sites, the manufacturing sites, or might that extend also to the miners who dug the uranium and had contamination that way?
Absolutely. The uranium miners and the downwinders from the different sites have a separate benefit called the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, and that's kind of folded into this benefit as well, where they can get a monetary benefit and may qualify also for medical help later on in their lives. So it's everybody in the nuclear weapons industry, whether it be digging the uranium or writing on the chalkboard and creating a bomb and everything in between.
And might this also extend to those who have been injured by the improperly stored nuclear weapons waste from World War II?
That's where we kind of get into a tricky area. If those people who were injured were employees or contractors of the nuclear site, then yes, they might be eligible for benefits. If it's a member of the general public, no. They are left to their own devices and will have to find a good lawyer to fight their claim for them.
Well, that's what's going on in St. Louis right now.
Exactly.
Is there anything else you feel that needs to be said that you haven't had an opportunity to say yet?
Well, I think you touched on an interesting point. You know, we're talking about the workers, and that is the meat of our company. You know, we tend to strive to look for workers. But there are folks in the communities that are being injured and don't even know it. In Livermore alone, here during the 60s and the 70s, the Livermore lab took plutonium sludge and gave it to people in the community for soil amendment for their gardens.
I'm sorry, I could not hold that one in. That's outrageous.
It is outrageous. And we love to tell a story of old plutonium workers when they were working at the lab, you know, in the 50s and 60s. If they got a dose of plutonium, their bosses would give them a bunch of water and a bunch of beer and tell them to pee it out. They'd go out to the local park, you know, go drink their beers and then urinate on the trees, and guess what? Guess what park has a bunch of plutonium readings on it?
That's one of the craziest things I've ever heard. And I hear crazy things. I deal with nuclear every week.
The men and women that I serve here in Livermore are usually the higher tech, higher educated PhDs, but we have a lot of laborers who came in and did some pipe fitting or did some welding or did some painting, and those are the folks that may be sick and don't realize why they're sick and don't realize that it could have been their work at the lab that made them sick.
So how do you go about reaching out to those people?
It's kind of a needle in the haystack, and I'm very busy all the time. I do a lot of outreach to unions, so I go to all of the different trade unions in the area, try and get folks to come and talk to me, get their work history. Sometimes their work history is spotty, and they can't prove that they worked at the lab. That's the other thing, is they have to be able to prove the time frames that they worked. And if their contractor wasn't listed or if lost their folders, they don't have a claim. If they can't do it, they have to rely on affidavits from other coworkers. We also have a Day of Remembrance celebration every October where we invite those folks that we know and those folks on our potential patient list to gather and remember the times of the Cold War, remember those who have passed, and celebrate the ones who are still living. And in those outreaches, we always ask, you know, have you had an illness? Do you need to file a claim? Here are the things to look for. And we give them resources to file claims with local representatives if they need to. And then once they have their medical card, they can come back and see us and see if they qualify for any medical care that we can give to them.
Laura Welch of Nuclear Care Partners. One of my most important takeaways from my interview with Laura is that uranium miners are eligible for government health benefits as long as they can prove that they were employed for 250 days during the years when a uranium mine was in operation. I'm certain that Leona Morgan of Diné No Nukes or Ian Zabarte of the Western Shoshone Nation would know more about the ins and outs of that issue. And I will try and track it down with one or both of them for a future Nuclear Hot Seat. Now back to that quote from Angela Hayes Carey of Nuclear Care Partners in Idaho, where she says that Hanford workers are sicker than those at INL and that they've got all 22 cancers recognized by the government. When I was able to interview Angela, she asked not to be recorded. But then she engaged in a long, intricate discussion with me about the various government programs that cover nuclear workers, the difficulty in coming up with hard numbers for Hanford workers who have developed cancers, or which cancers have shown up in Hanford workers, and in what proportion. To summarize our talk, still, in comparing the claims between the two sites, she provided government statistics to show that there is a significant difference in health claims between Idaho National Laboratories and the Hanford site. Using U.S. Department of Labor, Department of Energy statistics straight off the website under the Division of Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Act, or DEEOIC, as if that's any easier way to remember it, in order for workers to be eligible, they were employed on site at an atomic facility for a total of at least 250 days before February 1, 1992, and were monitored for radiation exposure with dosimetry badges or had jobs with similar exposures to those who were monitored. To date, Hanford workers have filed over 28,000 claims for compensation versus just over 8,000 for Idaho National Labs. So Hanford had nearly 3.5 times as many cases filed. Part B of the DEEOIC specifically covers radiogenic cancers. Hanford workers have filed 15,700 claims under Part B versus 4,100 claims for Idaho National Laboratories, or 3.75 times more cases. In terms of compensation for medical bills and exposure, Hanford employees have had more than 5 times the dollar amount of Idaho National Laboratory, $1,379 million in claims versus $265 million for Idaho National Labs. Note that for convenience, all of these numbers are rounded down, not up. The anecdotal assumption Angela Hayes made, and that was behind her quote, is that there are more and a wider variety of cancers and more illness in general in the Hanford cohort than that from Idaho National Laboratories. Given that there are 22 different cancers that make an individual worker eligible for compensation and medical care under Part B, one could assume that with over 15,000 claims, you would most likely find all of the 22 eligible cancers represented. So stepping away from Idaho National Labs for now, what's interesting is that there does not seem to be any kind of tally of how many of each of the cancers are specific to the Hanford site. Nor do we know the total number of Hanford employees currently being treated for radiogenic illnesses, those called by exposure to radioactive materials. And Nuclear Care Partners is one of many for-profit companies providing this care, at least a dozen and possibly more. If the DOE or Department of Labor has crunched the numbers to come up with overall statistics, these numbers do not seem to be available to the general public. When I pressed Angela for numbers from her company, she said that was proprietary information and would not be disclosed. I presume I'd get much the same response from other atomic health care companies. But what if a way could be found to combine the number from the companies so no one of them is outed in a way that could ding its business model, and that we could still find out the number of workers being given care and the illnesses they are being given care for? That would be the equivalent of an epidemiological study on the true current health impacts of radiation exposure on atomic facility workers. If anyone listening to Nuclear Hot Seat is interested in pursuing this, send an email to me at info@nuclearhotseat.com and let's see what we can come up with to gather these numbers. Then we could send them over to Forbes to conk-conka with some real nuclear facts instead of the usual pro-industry spin cycle that he spouts. And if you know that these stats already exist and know how to access them from official sources, let me know that too. Links to the statistics I have will be up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 308. My thanks to Angela Hayes Carey of Nuclear Care Partners in Idaho for her frankness and forthrightness. Hanford is just one example of how the inappropriate disposal of nuclear waste creates problems that persist, that will never go away, and continue to do their dirty work on our health and safety for years, decades, and truly millennia to come. Another site that is continually in the news is North St. Louis, where the Westlake landfill holds over 70,000 tons of illegally buried World War II nuclear weapons waste and is adjacent to the Bridgeton landfill, which has an underground fire that has been burning for 4 years, and there is no way to put it out. The fire is encroaching on the waste, and the waste has been spreading anyway ever since the end of World War II. An entire community of subdivisions has been built up around this area since it was the desolate wasteland where the waste was first hidden away. And homeowners there have been working on a variety of fronts to try to get some kind of satisfaction in terms of cleaning up the waste by switching it under the aegis of the Army Corps of Engineers, as opposed to the EPA, which has been useless, and also securing a buyout for residents of the homes that are closest to the landfill. This is an area known as Spanish Village. And it is where now 7 homes have been found to contain radioactive materials that can be traced to the landfill. 2 weeks ago, for Nuclear Hot Seat number 306, I interviewed homeowner Jan Huber and Dawn Chapman, one of the founders, along with Karen Nickel, of Just Moms STL. Dawn has been in this struggle for years and told us about the then-pending legislation in the Missouri State Legislature that would compensate the residents in Spanish Village for their homes, a buyout she was fighting for, though she was not in the area that would be affected by it and would not be able to take advantage of it. When we spoke, passage of SB 22 looked imminent. But politics being politics, well, I'll let Dawn Chapman tell you what happened.
Last week was not good for those of us who were involved in opposing the position of various nuclear entities in the world. In St. Louis, the last time we spoke, you and the others were very excited and enthusiastic that there was a bill up in the Missouri legislature that would provide for the buyout of the homes that are closest to the Westlake landfill, where in many instances radioactive materials have been found inside the home. Tell us what happened with that bill.
It was a David and Goliath battle with that bill. And to clarify and to make sure everyone knows, this bill was only for those living around Westlake. It had nothing to do with the other, with Coldwater Creek or anything like that. Believe it or not, there were some people who said it was too broad because they thought it included Coldwater Creek. And then there were some people who were from Coldwater Creek who wanted to be included. But this was just a Westlake bill because of the fire and because of the radioactive waste found. And a billion-dollar corporation showed its face. And I think that in this battle, you know, the name of the company, Republic, you know, these companies all have names. But when you're down there and you have a bill and you actually see these lobbyists that are hired by this and you see the vice president of the company sitting there, the bad guys, I guess, it's not left to your imagination anymore, if that makes any sense. You can actually visualize them and you can see them. And these are human beings like you who are actively running in and out of offices fighting against you and your community.
Tell us what it was that took place. There was a vote that was coming up, and there was optimism that you had the number of people necessary, the number of votes necessary to get this passed. What happened?
The opposition, the bad guys, did what they're good at doing, which is because we had the support we needed and because we had enough votes, they snuck in an amendment to the bill. that would sell one of the state parks, which never should have been a state park, and then use that money to fund the buyout of the people living closest to the landfill. And so obviously a lot of environmental organizations who were originally for the bill ended up having to oppose it, as did some of our key Democratic allies.
In other words, this was strictly opposed because suddenly they were going to be voting for the selling off of a park.
That's right. That's right. And to be honest, on Friday it was the vote. It went to the House floor and it was voted on, and we lost by only 14 votes. While we lost, and we are bruised, to have fought as hard as we did up against the amount of money that they were throwing at lobbyists, to have only lost this by 14 votes, and that was without our Democratic support, is pretty incredible.
When you say without your Democratic support, what does that mean?
The people that voted yes were the Republicans. The Democrats all voted no, or they did a no. They didn't vote at all. They abstained from voting. And so with Republican support, we got 14 votes shy of where we needed to be. So if we'd have had the Democrats on board, it would have been more than a majority that would have agreed that this was necessary.
This beggars comprehension. So there must be something that put this through the looking glass or reversed this. Why were the Democrats against?
The Democrats were against it because it was the selling of a state park, and they were worried that that set a precedent. And while I understand that, I think at the end of the day, they voted along the party line. And unfortunately, that's, I think, what's gotten them in hot water across the board. This is a people issue. And while state parks are beautiful, this particular park should not have ever been a state park in the beginning. And now you have the state park, which nobody uses, and you have all these people living here. So that was a mighty big disappointment to some of these people here. It was a hard pill to swallow.
Where does it go from here? You're obviously still stuck in the homes in Spanish Village and the areas around Westlake Landfill. We've still got the fire at Bridgeton, and it's still moving towards the underground radioactive nuclear weapons waste from World War II. What's the next step for the people who live in that area?
Well, we have to regroup as a community because there have been more homes now, just with this past week and weekend, that have been notified that they have radioactive waste in them. I believe we're up to 7 now. You know, we have to get with them and ask them what they want. What do you want? What do you want to do? And if they still want a buyout, well, then we have to proceed with Scott Pruitt, head of EPA on the federal level. We can always introduce federal legislation. Again, a lot of this depends on what they want to do. You know, I do not live in the buyout zone. And so I do not ever want to make a decision for anyone in there. It really is up to them. That's how we decide this. So if they still want a buyout, then we will still push for it on a different level. We can always try again next year in the Missouri legislature as well. But we also have to work at trying to get this site cleaned up and trying to prevent the fire from hitting the radioactive waste. It is very difficult not to get distracted right now. You know, people come first. People are living in contaminated homes. That's important. But there's also this massive, scary, dangerous thing happening. I mean, look what just happened with Hanford. That could affect the entire St. Louis metro area that we have to prevent. So we have a lot on our plate.
And how are you doing with all of this?
I am bruised and sore. But, you know, I've always described this fight as climbing a ladder that you can't see the top of. And what I'm really proud of, with Karen as well and everybody that helped out this week, we did not climb any rungs this week. We did not climb up, but I'll tell you, we hung on for dear life and we didn't fall down either. So we managed to hold on and stay right where we are. And then it's a matter of hanging on and seeing the opportunity and then being able to start climbing back up again. We're very proud of that. And I think where I am on an emotional level is I'm having a very difficult time giving people hope and empowering them that they can get involved, that they should get involved, because you can make change happen. Because they got to see that the table is definitely stacked against, I mean, everything's stacked against them. Our democracy doesn't work, Levy, the way that when you grow up, you're taught it works.
That has unfortunately been one of the hardest lessons that I've learned through my nuclear work, seeing how what I thought was in place and they taught me in civics class when I was a kid no longer seems to work because the rules got bent out of shape. And I don't know what's going to put them back together again.
No, but I mean, at the same time, I guess we can all agree that it's good that they got to see that, though, because nobody benefits from people's eyes being closed and not seeing that that's happening. And so I think that that is something that you're going to see more and more of is these people are feisty mad about it. They've been betrayed on a level that's so high they can't really see. And when you're dealing with our issue, you're dealing with people that are sick, too. So it takes a lot out of them. They don't have the energy that other people have. And so there's the other thing that you're fighting, trying to keep people involved and to try and forge a path forward.
Well, I'm convinced that if anyone can do this and rally the troops, it's you. And that would only be after you give yourself a rest from this, a little bit of time to regroup, gather your energy, clear your brain cells, get whatever rage is in you out, and then place it in the right place to be energy to move this forward. Because from everything I know of you, you're not going to bail on this. However, you are allowed to take a breather.
Well, you're doing that next week. But I will say something else, too. You know, for those that listen to the hearing, and we will have a link that you can listen to it. My goodness, we came out of this with a tremendous amount of allies. I mean, that understand this issue and just think it's terrible. There were some people that voted no simply because they didn't feel like it was the state's responsibility, but they thought that it was the federal government's responsibility. And while I don't agree with them voting no because of that, that still for us is a tremendous win to have that acknowledgement.
I have no doubt but that when you do get your rest and then regroup and pull things together with the new allies you have, there's always the next legislative session, and hopefully nothing catastrophic will happen with the Westlake landfill and with that radioactive waste before then, and you can get some satisfaction on this issue.
Well, thank you so much for covering it the way that you do and doing it so well.
Dawn Chapman of Just Moms STL. You can follow the group on Facebook, and when you sign up, also go to Westlake Landfill and Kristen Camuso's page, Humans of Westlake Landfill. As this nuclear tragedy continues to unfold, know that we will continue to cover it on Nuclear Hot Seat. Activist shout out! A couple of regional actions that any of us can participate in. Hanford Challenge has issued an action alert to support their mission of fighting for safety and accountability by the government towards weapons complex workers and to fight for government accountability by protecting workers from toxic chemical vapor exposures, protecting the public from radiological and chemical threats due to Hanford's aging and deteriorating facilities of the kind that led to the Purex tunnel collapse, and ensure that a plan is created for stabilizing Hanford's tank waste with vetting from a large network of Hanford stakeholders, agencies, and tribes. The request is to call senators from Washington State and Oregon, and also representatives in Washington, both Democrat and Republican. We'll have a link up to the phone numbers on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 308. And here's one out of Canada that really tickles me. The original deadline for submitting written comments to the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission in relation to the proposed Chalk River mega dump of radioactive materials has now been officially extended for at least 3 months, from May 17, tomorrow, until at least August 16, 2017, and perhaps even later. The reason why? The environmental impact statement that they issued, which was almost 1,000 pages long, was not made available in French, even though Chalk River is directly across the river from Quebec, and even though the Ottawa River runs down to Montreal, where it joins the St. Lawrence River. You try translating 1,000 pages of dry technical information. But thanks to Dr. Gordon Edwards and the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, there are some great two-page summaries that have been prepared so that you'll know what to say and how to comment. That will also be up on the website. You heard me say it. I don't need to say it again. And watch this space for an upcoming special show on nonviolent civil resistance with interviews with people who have done that same thing. It's going to be guest produced by Sheila Parks, and we look forward to including her in the Nuclear Hot Seat family of special correspondents. Here's today's final thought. It's a well-known axiom within the anti-nuclear movement that the first official response to any nuclear accident or emergency is, no problem, no radiation release, no one was hurt, move along, nothing to look at, pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. We saw this again with Hanford, when less than 1 hour after the tunnel collapse at the Purex facility was discovered, they were saying, no radiation release. Well, how did they know there was no radiation release, when that was the clue that pointed to the accident having happened in the first place? The EPA reading, taken at the Richmond monitoring facility the previous day and only posted that morning, showed a spike in gamma 5 radiation 2.5 times above safety level. Gamma 5 being the radionuclide that relates to used radioactive materials such as were stored in the tunnel. So why the automatic denial? Well, it's pretty obvious that the policy followed by those in the nuclear industry is one that manages potential panic before it can happen, frames the discourse and perception as, we know what we're doing and you don't have to worry, despite the fact that time and time again, the nuclear industry's hubris, ignorance, cavalier attitude towards waste and the public, and a grossly misplaced sense of entitlement have led us to the brink, and sometimes over the edge, of nuclear disaster. Since the Hanford accident happened the same day that Trump fired FBI Director Comey, the story has been buried, diminished, fobbed off. Yet within 24 hours, it was obvious what was happening. Even though the majority of personnel on Hanford were ordered to stay home, there was a no-fly zone, and people in the adjacent town were urged to stay indoors, the pro-nukers pulled out their favorite pro-nuke shill, James Conca, to assure us that we're all a bunch of ninnies if we bother to be worried about something as irrelevant as a little tunnel collapse on a nuke site. Or as he said in a heated Twitter exchange with investigative journalist Ronan Farrow, still nonsense. You can always find cancers everywhere. No connection to work at Hanford. We tried for years. Yet now you've heard other voices, both last week on the show and here today, from those who deal with sick workers. So what might be happening on the site, and how might it be covered up? What is the ultimate truth? Will we, the public, ever know it? All we can do here at Nuclear Hot Seat is follow the trail of breadcrumbs and see where they lead. As for mainstream media, they need to get with the program and pay attention to nuclear with a lot more skepticism, research, and analysis than they've exhibited so far. Nuclear waste will continue to do what it has always done, release radiation, poison our resources, inflict cancer and other health problems on the population. And while this is happening, our purported leaders, most of our media, and of course, the nuclear industry, pretend everything is fine when it most definitely is not. Hanford is yet another warning of what happens when the infrastructure that's supposed to keep nuclear waste in check ages and decays and then collapses. This site is not alone in its dangers. Westlake Landfill in North St. Louis, uranium tailings from every mine on native and national parklands throughout the West, the insane attempt by Southern California Edison to house San Onofre's long-lived plutonium-laden spent fuel rods in 5/8-inch thick stainless steel canisters less than 100 feet from the Pacific Ocean, and so on and so on and so many more. Nuclear insanity puts us in harm's way not for an election cycle or two or 10, but forever. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years and is dangerous for 20 half-life cycles, or 480,000 years. If that's not forever, I don't know what is. And the problems that are showing up at storage and treatment sites, put that in quotes, that are only 40, 50, 70 years old, will be repeated in other nuclear sites, all of them, as the years go by. The ultimate power of nuclear is the power to destroy us all from the DNA on up, though we're getting conditioned to expect that as this new Cold War heats up. But all it needs is a steady release of radiation against which we cannot defend ourselves and which accumulates in our bodies over the years until its negative effects make themselves known. So learn what you can about the industry and what's going on specifically in your area. Be skeptical of all assurances of safety. Ask hard questions of your elected officials, and anytime you can get to those people who are in charge of a nuclear facility of any kind near you. And take steps to protect your health. Then, as regards the nuclear industry, give them hell. After all, that's what they've made manifest on Earth. The eternal hellfire of the nuclear reaction and the eternal damnation of what it does to our DNA. Don't let them roll over us. Check out the activist groups, get informed, fight back. After all, it's only our lives, our genetic future, and the planet that's at stake. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 16, 2017. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from Spokesan.com, King5.com, and ACE reporter Susanna Frame, TriCitiesHerald.com, and its ACE reporter Annette Carey, CapeCodTimes.com, and their ACE reporter Christine Legere, PublicIntegrity.org, KPDI.com, Reuters.com, FukuLeaks.org, and Simply Info with Nancy Faust, Bob Alvarez. Thanks to Julie Wirt of Radiation Watch for updates on EPA radiation readings in the Northwest, and Matt Hallstrunk for his posted readings in Corvallis, Oregon. For the story on highly radioactive shipments of liquid waste from the Chalk River site in Canada to Savannah River site in South Carolina, thanks to Gordon Edwards, the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, in conjunction with Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear, Michael Keegan of Coalition for Nuclear-Free Great Lakes, and Environmental Coalition attorney Terry Lodge. Other sources for today's program include Fukushima311voices.wordpress.com, globalnews.ca, Hanford Challenge, dianuke.org, kdvr.com, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission event reports, thanks to Erica Gray, and a shout-out to the big-hearted planet protectors and peaceful warriors who gather at the Nuclear Hot Seat blog site on Facebook. We're closing in on 2,000 likes. We're almost there, guys. So if more of you could come to the Nuclear Hot Seat blog page, the one with the logo on it, and click on like, it would be great to get there by our 6th anniversary. And of course, while you're there, read the stories, share the links, and learn what you can. Theme music for Nuclear Hot Seat, written by me, sung by Marilee Weber, accompaniment by John Barnard, and recorded at Winslow Court Studio in Hollywood. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2017, Libby Halevy and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed as long as proper attribution is provided. And a reminder that if you appreciate weekly, verifiable news updates about nuclear issues from around the world, delivered with as much humor as humanly possible, take a moment to send a supporting donation to nuclearhotseat.com. This is Libby Halevy of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency starts, but we can never come up with a date when it's over, because it never ends. There, you've all had your nuclear wake-up call, so don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
to UCY.tv.